they did not get the chance to respond. Around the change of the agreement protocol as part of the network. So I would like to start there. When you are ready, you may engage. Thank you. Thank you.
taking them to forecast, setting them to the animal. That goes beyond the collective bargaining settings. And it is those kinds of goods and services that is being intended to cover. In as much as society, association, and other groups do offer services to their members, and we think that those members should therefore be protected in terms of this bill, because they are consumers like any other consumer, and we take those associations, those clubs, those trade unions, those collectivities to be suppliers in the meaning of the bill. So it is in that sense, Chair, that we have included trade union in section 5(6). And we think that it is appropriate. However, to the extent that they have the wording as the presentation by Netflix says, that appropriate wording is prepared in regard. So if, however, the wording in the current bill needs to be tweaked, we do recognize the fact that they have to care to do that. And we will do that in our comprehensive response to the committee next week. Chairperson, I think probably that is going to be the first issue, and we do not think that there is any deviation from what was agreed to with regard to that particular issue. Chair, the next issue relates to the whole question of decriminalization. And you will recall that in our briefing to the committee, we did indicate that one of the objectives of the bill is to try and decriminalize where appropriate, where possible, and to deal with such matters in an administrative penalty manner where appropriate. However, obviously, we will not be decriminalizing each and every aspect of the deal. And in that regard, the presentation by the executive director of Netflix, again, under the slide that says criminal function, it says criminal function may not be adequate or capable. And then there is a challenge of moving some regulations that currently attracts criminal function to a different region. And then it says further work required. So clearly, Chairperson, there was no argument on the particular matter, but that further work was needed or was required. The issue at hand, or the concern that was raised by Labour yesterday, is the fact that sections of the merchandise market that are being
thank you very much, Mr. Sivan. Any additions? Thank you very much, Mayor Mahalka. I think that's very clear quoted. I availed the opportunity to the department just to give their clarity. That help me?
Thank you, Chair. Well, welcome, by the department. As I understand, this is still working. This is not still in the pipeline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for this opportunity to address you on this call and good morning to everybody here. Let me say why I'm glad that we're finally getting consumer protection legislation, but unfortunately the current bill, in my view, is not good enough for effective consumer protection in some respects, and it also has some other problems. Now, you will have received two documents from of my submission. You'll see from the first one that I've got 17 number submissions involved on Chapter 2, Part G. That is the part on unfair contract terms, the human rights of fair contract terms, and that starts Section 48 and ends at Section 52. Now, in the rest of my submissions, I've also got 16 other submissions on other parts of the ball. And apart from that, part of my submission is an extra file with the proposed wording for sections on unfair contract terms. Now, obviously, I can't even deal with a tenth of these submissions, even if the chair is nice to me and gives me longer than the 20 minutes allocated. And so I've decided to just give you a taste of some of my submissions with a little bit of motivation and trust that the DTI will therefore also respond to all my other submissions on unfair contract terms and on other parts of the bill. Now, my major problem with this bill is the provision Let me give you some background to my explanation. I'm a professor of contract law in Stellenbosch, and I've spent 10 months sabbatical in Europe only looking at how the problem of unfair contracts are dealt with in legislation in other countries. And I've also looked at whatever models I could find in other parts of the world, including Brazil and the model of consumer protection in Africa, Zimbabwe, consumer contract act, etc. And if you compare our rules to these models, it does not provide effective protection for ordinary consumers in the area of unfair contract terms. There are many ways in which we can make this bill work more effectively in practice. Now, my concern is that most consumers, and particularly poor consumers, cannot afford to go to court to argue whether a particular term is unfair under Section 48 of the bill. Well, Section 48 says, all unfair terms are prohibited, and then apart from that, we've got a relatively short list of prohibited clauses in Section 51. Okay? So, most consumers can't afford to go to court to go and argue with business about what unfair terms mean. Poor consumers can't even afford to travel to the closest provincial office to go and complain that they actually found an unfair term in their contract. So, what I want to see for these consumers, and for all consumers in this country, is proactive control. Not just reactive control, reacting and going to court to complain, but proactive control, which tries to prevent the problem of unfair contract terms in the first place. And what I want to see in this bill are tried and tested mechanisms from Europe and elsewhere, which help to prevent unfair contract terms being included in the first place. So I don't want the effectiveness of our provisions to be dependent on consumers having to go to court to fight with well-paid lawyers about what unfair contract terms mean. Now, what are these mechanisms that I'm talking about that are used throughout Europe and in other parts of the world, but are not in our law? So you'll see my first submission on phase one involved. Talks about the most important mechanism that we need for effective redress. And this is a so-called gray list. So I say there that a non-exhaustive gray list of contract terms which are presumed to be unfair unless the supplier proves otherwise must be included in this part of the law, irrespective of true consumer contracts at least. And this is crucial. Okay, so a gray list, you make it clear in the legislation that it's not this general prohibition against unfair terms, but on top of that, we also have a list which gives more guidance as to which terms, at the very least, should be treated with caution by businesses. Okay? And you make it clear that other clauses that's not in the list can still be unfair under the general prohibition against unfair terms. But at least you give more guidance as to the types of clauses that businesses must think carefully about before they drop their contract. Okay? And you will see there in my submissions that I say that gray lists are regarded as crucial for effective consumer protection in other countries and in the rest of the world and by international experts. And one of the basic models which the drafters of our bill should have looked at when drafting unfair terms is the European directive on unfair terms in consumer contracts. I refer to that me give you a few examples of the advantages of including a grader. So again, a grader is a list of tools which are presumed to be unsafe, but the business still has the opportunity to come forward and say, well, we've got special reasons why in our case it's still safe. So it's a flexible instrument. Right? So one of the advantages is it promotes self-imposed control. By which I mean the business, conscientious businesses are likely to react more quickly to a more specific provision in a gray list and use the gray list as a checklist to look at which clauses should they take out of their contract because they might be usually unfair. Okay, so that's why I say it's proactive. It's more likely that the business will react to that, take out those clauses, if you merely tell them, take out any unfair clause. You have to tell them that as well, but it's not good enough. Okay, so as far as less conscientious businesses are concerned, let's say the consumer sees a term in the contract which he thinks breaches. But now the business doesn't want to remove it. The business is going to be more likely to remove it before the consumer says, oh, if the consumer says to the business, look, that term is in the gray list. There's less likelihood that the business will say, no, I'm going to defend this case up to the highest court. Right. If it's already presumed to be unfair because it's in the gray list. So if we just leave the general prohibition against unfair terms on its own, businesses are more likely to go and fight the case in the court. If it's in the gray list, they're more likely to say, okay, the case is already presumed to be unfair, we agree it's unfair, you don't have to take it to court. Okay. So if the case does go to court, at least the burden of proving fairness will be on the business, not on the consumer. Now, burden of proof is something in law, which means that if the court is not persuaded either way, it will go against the party who has to prove the case. Okay? As the bill is written now, the burden of proving unfairness will be on the consumer. Okay? If you put the clause in a gray list, they are presumed to be unfair until the business proves the contrary. So if the court is finally unclear, the business did not bring enough evidence on what reasons one makes it necessary to take this clause into their contract, then the consumer will win the day. So the onus on the business to say, well, in our situation, insurance is so costly that we have to protect ourselves against negligence and so on. They know best what the evidence of the business considerations are which requires that clause. They must bear the burden of putting that evidence before the court. And I can give you examples from case law in the past where our courts have said it's a clearly unfair clause that they couldn't decide either way under the common law. They can just presume that there are good business reasons for this clause, so they'll go against the consumer. Now, so as I say, the gray list improves the chances of the legislation having fast, real, and proactive effect. We can't just wait on the court to eventually give us guidance as to what unfair terms mean. That might take a long time before it's crystallized in practice. And what we must remember is that consumer cases will mostly go to the lower court, not to the high court. And the lower courts, their decisions are not reported in writing. So if some magistrate in some town decides that term is unfair, or usually unfair, not even a lawyer will know that that was said in that magistrate. So the message won't filter down to businesses until eventually the high court in a number of years' time has started to say these terms are unfair. If we have a brainer, tried and tested from other countries, then we are more likely to have guidance earlier for businesses which types of business clauses must they treat with caution. Now, gray list has some advantages for businesses as well. It's more likely that the rewriting of their standard terms of their contract will be a one-off expense if they have better guidance as to what should be in their contract. Okay, and the other thing is that a conscientious business there's an even greater danger that conservatives, if you leave it like it is, there's an even greater danger that conservative judges will interpret the general clause of Section 48 narrowly than if they had a greater. Because if they've got a greater in front of them, they've got to have good reason why, at least in respect of those clauses, they must have good reasons not to find the term unfair. Okay, and any danger that control will be limited to the listed clauses is far outweighed by the greater danger that we won't have proactive control if we don't have a list. Another response which might be given is that why don't we just rush through the legislation as it is and we put the greater in the regulation? Okay. There are several reasons why it should not be in the regulation, why the greater should be in the text of the legislation itself. This is a substantive part of the legislation. It fleshes out the concept of unfair contract terms, what that means. Things as substantive as that should be in the text of the legislation, should not be left open to the minister. Not quite a monetary threshold or a form that has to be filled in and so on. And also, if it's in the legislation, it's got bigger legitimacy. There's less likelihood of businesses challenging it on the basis of the ultra virus, you know, which means that the minister exceeded his power and so on. And also, if it's in the legislation itself, it's more visible to the media, to consumer organizations and so on, will at least read the text of this act, perhaps, but not go so far as to waive the law and waive all the regulations as well. Now, as far as the experience in the UK is concerned, I think the DDI used in 1977, or people who draft this legislation, looks to me like they used the 1977 UK Unfair Contract Terms Act, because there are some wording from that, especially in the previous draft, the list of factors came just like that from the 1977 legislation. Now, the UK actually implemented the directive only in the 1990s, and that's the legislation that is used in respect of consumer contracts in the UK. Now, maybe the fact that I'm speculating that the DPI may have ignored these in this 1990s legislation because that was in the form of regulation. But I want to explain this. The only reason why the UK government put the whole of the government, not just the list, in regulation, was that they would otherwise have missed the deadline of the European Commission for implementing the directive. So they didn't quickly do it in regulation. There wasn't time to go through the parliamentary process. In the meantime, that regulation is actually conflict with the 1977 Act. It's not regulated under the Act. So in the meantime, they asked the Law Commission to draft new unfair contract terms legislation. So in the new unfair contract terms Act of the Law Commission, they've now put the graders and the whole of the directors in the text of the legislation itself. And this goal of the Law Commission has been accepted in principle by the UK Law Government, which is what they're waiting for it to go to Parliament. Okay, so they put the graders in the text of the legislation itself, and that's how it works in the rest of Europe and in other countries like Brazil, Zimbabwe, and so on. Okay? Now, I hope you agree with me that we need a grader. That you will take the time to go through the grey list that I propose should be in the legislation. It's going to make it more likely that you'll have proactive control, that businesses will remove those clauses voluntarily. Okay? I've got other submissions on unfair contract terms as well. I can't go through all of them. Let me just refer you to one or two. On page 4 of my grain submission, I've put it at the bottom. My second submission involved, I say that the list of relevant factors which a court must consider to decide whether a term is unfair under Section 48 should be amended. If not in line with international best practice, and it won't work well in practice as it is. It will depend too much on consumers or consumer organizations having to go to court to go and argue about what unfair terms means. We should prevent unfair contracts and from even appearing in the contract in the first place. We've got these mechanisms from other countries which I deal with in detail here. Okay, I'm almost finished, but what I also will say is that I also think that sometimes the bill is unclear. I mentioned that on page 11 of my submission, number 40. It's not clear to me whether the consumer can only go to court to complain about unfair contract terms, or can it go to the tribunal as well. So I remember that in the DPI's initial briefing on this bill to this committee, they said that they've got a deal with the Department of Justice that only the courts will deal with contract issues. But this is not clear from the bill, not even to a lawyer like myself. Okay, and it doesn't help to say that we will make it clear in consumer education. The bill itself mustn't be conflicting and contradictory. And so I think we must, the committee must deliberate on should contract issues be limited to the court, and if so, this should be made clear in the court. But at the moment, section 51 of the unfair contract terms only refers to the court's power without saying expressly that only a court may hear this. And this seems to conflict with section 69 and section 4 on who you must approach if you have a problem with your consumer rights. Now, I'll just mention, if the chair would allow me, just one or two of my submissions on other parts of the bill. As I said, my main problem is the provisions on unfair contract terms. It's not in line with what's happening in the rest of the world. But I also have problems with other parts of the bill. I'm just going to mention two, just to give you an idea. Right? I've got a problem with section 14, which relates to fixed term agreements. And I say that on page 15 of my submission, number 94. Okay? So, Section 14 allows the consumer to cancel any fixed-term contract on 20 days' notice. Now, I think this is problematic in leases and probably other fixed-term contracts which may fall under that. Just to show you that I'm not just on the part of the consumer, I also am thinking that this bill is not always fair to businesses either. So I understand leases of land, leases of immovable property, power, etc., to be covered by this Act. And it seems that fixed-term leases, at least for a year or 6 months, is also covered by this Section 14. So it means that the lessee will be able to cancel the lease contract on only 20 days' notice, and that no compensation will be paid to the lessor if he suffers damages as a result. Okay. So let's say you were renting out of a flat in Stellenbosch. There's a good reason for you to limit the student to a year or 6 months lease, because in the middle of the semester you're going to find it difficult to find other students if he gives you 20 days notice. Alright? And now the student can just give you 20 days notice, he's out, and even if you advertise as much as you can, it takes 2 months before you find another student, you won't be able to claim any compensation for that student not keeping to his word and leaving you in the middle of the semester. Okay, now, don't say that there's a cancellation penalty provided for in Section 14. However, that cancellation penalty won't help the lessor, because that cancellation penalty only refers to a penalty if you receive some goods or if you receive a discount as part of a contract. So this typically refers to the cell phone contract. The consumer got a cell phone for free, he got the cell phone contract at a lower rate because he was prepared to bind himself for 2 years. But that penalty doesn't apply in the lease contract. So the poor lessor will have no right to compensation as he would have had under the common law. Okay, and then another section, so in fact, this takes away the lessor's common law rights too much, I think. another example of a case where the consumer protection actors stand now actually gives the consumers less rights than it has under the common law of contract. You know, I would have thought that they will, at least the consumers should be protected to the extent that they are under the common law. And this is, you must think very carefully of taking away common law rights or not reinforcing the common law idea of what is fair provision. All right, so that example is section 54. And that's the consumer's right to demand quality service. Now, if you look at that section, you'll see in section 2 that if the supplier fails to perform a service, you know, to the standards required, it will be the supplier's choice whether they will remedy the defect in the service or refund the consumer the price paid. Whereas, under the common law, if it's a serious problem with the services, the consumer will have the choice whether to cancel or not, not the supplier. The consumer will have the choice to say, I'd rather don't trust you to try and remedy what you've done wrong. I'd rather get out of this contract and get a refund and do it with somebody else. Now, it's the option of the supplier. So, I don't see why the consumer should have less rights under the common law than under the common law. Sure, I think then we should at the very least have a savings clause here, which says the common law rights are retained in addition to those in the law. Okay. Or something like that. And that's not the only example where I think the consumer has less rights under the common law. I'm not even talking about the situations where, in other parts of this law, the consumer has less rights than it would have under international instruments, such as European Consumer Directive, which gives the consumer more rights than under this law. Another example is Section 61 on product liability. I'm not going to discuss that now, but I say there that under the common law, a consumer who buys directly from a manufacturer has anyway got full strict entitlement to compensation if the damage, if the good causes damage to the consumer, if the good causes a loss to the consumer. But under the law, there are certain defenses to the manufacturer. They can get out of that liability. Now, I know in the present consumer, somewhere else they do say that the consumer can always claim compensation as allowed under the common law. But it just seems to me that if we looked at more carefully at what's happening internationally under product liability, under consumer sales, under unfair contract terms, we could have had better protection for the consumer than under this form. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Prof. Chakri Nudin. Opportunity for members for questions. Mr. Labaskasi, followed by Farida.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Professor, for a very comprehensive document that will require a fair amount of study. Am I correct in understanding that your grey list would actually should or could go a long way in eliminating the small print, to put it that way? And you know, usually we have contracts, how many contracts can you have phases of small print, which most of us, my time, because it wasn't good enough for them, certainly, many few of us see all the small print. The smaller the print is usually the more onerous the conditions on the purchaser. So therefore, a grey list will go a long way in eliminating these tiny little conditions that are hidden away in small print. question of risk, which I think perhaps you could just very briefly, because that's a very unfair state of government's law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lassar. Members, when you refer to the good professor submission, let's remember there must be one and be two. Unless you are referring to
V1,
just direct us to is it V1 or V2?
Yeah, V1 okay. Page 18.12. V1 page 18.12 at the bottom.
Thank you, Mr. Lafayette. Congress Farida Mohammed.
Thank you, Chair. I want to also compliment the professor because this is quite a detailed research paper. Seems like quite a detailed study. But I want to perhaps ask two general questions because I think most of the clauses that you've referred to, you've given, they're self-explanatory. So I don't find the necessity to actually engage you on that because your paper is detailed. But I want to ask to understand that you have compared our document, at least our legislation with the UK, Germany, Netherlands, and other ones. I would want us to perhaps some kind of analysis from your side in terms of how did they implement the legislation. Did they have challenges in capacity? And how did their legislation pan out? If that was also your research that you looked at. I didn't manage to go through every clause here because we didn't have the time. Perhaps if you could just comment on the return of goods in the 30 or 60 days and refer me to that, perhaps that would help as well. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. The next is Comrade Hassan.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, I tend to welcome you to this submission by the I think it is good. It is worth considering. By committee when we went through this bill. I think it was actually a better intention of protection of consumers. And the most striking issue is that it was the wrong way to, for us, yeah.
chemist intended that day. How we should be greatest of that least of all the myths could have been introduced, you know, some time to cause the, you know, issues that have either direct or potentially profound significance on any kind of legislation. It's helpful if they are brought in good time. So that enough time to consider them, talk them back and forth, moving and promoting that. I wonder what could have, you know, talked to or is that an idea from doing that area on? The questions are, first, the it has research to an extent that doesn't give picked up any financial implications on the intersection of creating on the term. The assumption is that the first reaction that SLMDs would have, or any business for that matter, would be to run to lawyers in order to get clarification in principle. The contracts are amongst the therefore in business transactions, if not the main one. The second one is the Professor Tierke contends that the credit should be in the primary legislation, the act of the central regulation. I know she's gone through that, you know, motivating for it. But the question still lingers at the back of my mind is that if a list of these unfair terms is going to be included, how exhaustive or non-exhaustive is that? Obviously, my question is loaded because I see regulations as being more flexible. Should there be a situation down the line during the implementation of the law that another term or another term gets discovered due to practice? What I consider quite positively, the rationale of sustainability, what if something also just gets discovered? The dimension of the state, because the bill also seeks to include the state as a service provider in one way or another. Well, of course, Representative, I'm sure, would help us with out of hand search and in her argument in certificate content around the unfair. Take into account that the state as well has got agencies, not just departments, but even agencies that act on behalf of the state. Some are using outside, you know, people in the company. The last one, check it. Just out of day-to-day experience, oral contracts or contracts that are done over the telephone, I've had been exposed to a very unfortunate experience on that one. So, as Professor Deer went through her presentation, you know, that experience came up. It was the new practice, you know, traditionally or conventionally,
understood in it well. But otherwise, General K, you know, we definitely assume the respect that you're coming to left to really look into questions we need to the same. So we'll be very, very, you know. What strikes me is that he claims strongly that he believes in the provided left to taxi care from that to the international team, but to the mother. I'm just commenting. That could have been covered given the amount of error. And of course, I feel that that is quite articulated to the judgment so that we can look exactly which areas is referring to. Thank you. Thank you very much. Next is Men Tuli, who will be followed by Dr. Hart.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just one small question, one or two small questions. On V2, right at the beginning, you say you
envision. Men Tuli, could you give us the page? The first page.
The first page, yes. Can I continue? Okay, thank you. You see, ideally we should have separate legislation dealing comprehensively with unfair terms, as is done in many other countries. Probably with differentiated level of control for true consumers. It's called business, you continue in business to business. Now, my question would be, is there an example that you can give us of the legislation that are dealing with unfair terms, with asset rates that you've got from other countries that we can look at? And the second one is on it's on the document V1. On page 14, section 4.4b, you say it is unsatisfactory and should be removed. Now you talk about B that allows a court to go beyond interpreting a contract strictly and to give it a meaning which, on normal or strict interpretation, it cannot have. Now you say we do not need this provision to protect consumers, but he or on unfair terms already allows a court to strike out unfair terms which goes beyond what a reasonable person would ordinary contemplate or expect. Maybe if you can elaborate a bit on this one and give us an example on what you're really talking about, practically, what do you mean? Yeah, thank you. So,
mentally, thank you very much, Dr. Rana. Thank you, Chair. I think it's a very, very interesting submission here. I want to congratulate you. I think I've studied fair submission. I'm quite certain, Chairman, you, page 13 of V1 or V2, Dr. This is the V1, Chairman. I'm quite certain, Professor McGee, you say that, or you say that you need the statistics of everything adequate as far as 10,000 is concerned. I've asked you, I agree that we need protection for small businesses and all franchising agreements, but I think we need separate franchising legislation, as not all the provisions in the law suitable for truth. established upon this, why do we need to separate legislation for train drivers? As a layman, I'd like to have your views on that as well. Thank you, Chairman.
Dr. Ali, thank you very much. Professor Ludia, you have a very full basket of comments and questions, so you can just work your way through it studiously. Comrade Ntamise, I need to nip out for a minute. Would you kindly change my absence?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Committee. Okay, Mr. Cockney, on whether the grade has gone all the way towards eliminating fine print. I think certainly we eliminate the fine print that are completely biased and skewed against the consumer. I think obviously businesses should be allowed to use standard terms to make sure that all their employees contract on the same terms as untrained employers and so on. But I think the grade will do a lot to get businesses right from the start to at least eliminate those that are completely unsafe. Okay? And as far as page 18 on risk is concerned, that's B1, page 18, number 12, I said there, we need a provision on the transfer of risk as the common law rules of contract in this area are unfair towards buyers. But I say the BPI in their law has tried to give us a provision on risk which is better than the common law, but I don't think it's sufficient. And that's section 19.2c. It says there that goods to be delivered remain at the supplier's risk until the consumer has accepted delivery of them in accordance with the section. Now that's much better than the common law, because the common law says risk can already pass even though the consumer doesn't yet have the goods, they're still the supplier, right? If the contract is so-called perfecta, as long as the price is fixed, we know what the price is, we know what the goods are, and there's no condition, suspensive conditions which says this contract is conditional about this first happening before it can be bought. That's what the common law says. Already at that point, which is normally immediately on completion of the contract, the consumer carries the risk. Which means that if something happens to the goods they are accidentally destroyed, the consumer still pays, even though he doesn't have the goods, even though they were destroyed while they were with the supplier. So that's the common law. So the DTI provision is better, the current law provision is better, because it says risk only passes on delivery, which is fine at the point of departure. Okay, but if you see what's happening in the rest of the world, that is a bit skewed towards the consumer, because the situation I point out is sometimes the risk must pass earlier than delivery to be fair to the business as well, to the supplier as well. And that is when the consumer knows that the business is ready for delivery, the consumer was supposed to already pay delivery, but he delayed. Okay? So he's late in taking delivery. The business wants to deliver, but it can't because the consumer doesn't come and take delivery. Now at that point, when the consumer knows he's supposed to take delivery now, he's in breach of his obligation to take delivery. From that point, the supplier should no longer carry the risk because he's done all that he can to get it to deliver the goods. That's what I'm saying. So I don't know, I'm glad that it's only passed on delivery, but I think it's fair for the supplier to see what's happening in the rest of the world. Sometimes it must be earlier than delivery. So I can assist further if you want me to draft a provision in this regard in the light of what's happening in, for example, the principles of European law on sales, the United Nations Convention on the International Sale of Goods and so on. Is that a sufficient answer, Mr. Lutzer? Okay. Then, Mohammed, thanks for your question. You asked me how did the Europeans implement their legislation? Did they have any capacity problems and so on? Before I am going to answer directly, but before I do so, let me just say that if we have a capacity problem in this country, if we've got less money than Europe to throw at this problem of unfair contractors, the grading becomes even more important. Okay? Because it strengthens the hands of consumers without having to complain to anybody. They can just say firstly, it's more likely that these things will be removed voluntarily, after consumer having to complain, because they know better what they've got to remove. Secondly, if they have to complain, they don't have to go, the National Consumer Commission doesn't have to be involved in lengthy litigation with the business. If it's in the grey list, they're more, the business is more likely to give up and say, right, the term is usually unfair. But okay, as far as the patent process is concerned, in the UK, they've got the Office of Fair Trading. After the directive was implemented, the Office of Fair Trading, like our National Consumer Commission, was given the authority to act against businesses who use unfair contract terms. And in fact, they were given the obligation to consider all complaints, and unless the complaint is frivolous or vexatious, they are supposed to do something about it, and they are supposed to take the business to court to get an interdict against the business to stop using those terms in all future contracts. So you don't have to involve an individual consumer going to court like we have in our bill, basically. The National Consumer Commission is equivalent to this. And what they found in the UK is that this costs a lot of money. So they have a dedicated team of lawyers at the Office of Fair Trading, and I think that they've got a huge budget, which they only spend on unfair contractors. So I think I don't think we're necessarily going to get all that much money just to spend on the problem of unfair contractors. And so that's why I want proactive mechanisms in the text of the legislation itself, which will empower consumers more. And empower consumer watchdogs more when they're dealing with business. Okay. Alright? You said to me on a comment on the return of goods. Now that's not really part of my submissions, I think. And I'm not sure what exactly what we could comment on. Mr. Chairman, I'd like to ask you to repeat the question.
You may, if you can just.
I think I'll accept because I couldn't manage to go through your whole document. But
okay.
The way your presentation you mentioned that, because many of the presenters were addressing the issue.
Yeah.
But perhaps you could look at it and come back to us.
Okay.
If you have some time. Thank you. For
sure.
And then, honorable Mayne, you said where does the name Grey List come from? I think I am aware that I think politically insensitive in this country to talk about a black list. I've talked about this to my cousins speaking friends, and they say, no, they don't feel insulted. I can talk about a black list when I mean a list of prohibited clauses. It's just a short term use. Grey list is something between a black list. You know, it's not completely prohibited like a black list, but it's grey because the clauses are just presumed to be unfair. There's still a chance that the business may prove in the particular circumstances that they say. That's why I'm saying it's grey. It's not blacklisted, it's not prohibited outright. The clause is not presumed to be unfair. They would usually be unfair. But we need this business a chance to come and say, in my particular circumstance, I can assume the clause. Let me give you an example. We can talk about in a longer term a non-enforced indicative list of clauses which are presumed to be unfair unless the contrary is proven. So the word grade is used everywhere in Europe, basically, to refer to that. So an example might be, you know, in the directive itself, in the European directive, they specifically grade a clause excluding liability for bodily injury or death caused by negligence. And negligence more generally as well. So, let's say a private hospital, as they do at the moment, include a clause in their fine print saying the patient that comes to this hospital cannot sue this hospital for negligence, even if this is the negligently causing bodily injury or death. MediClinic doesn't have such a bad clause, but all the rest of them have that clause. This grade will say that clause is presumed to be unfair. But we leave it. I think personally that will always be unfair. But let's say the hospitals come and say, well, in our particular case, you know, the cost of insurance is so high that we've got to place a cap on the liability. We can say we can't pay out more than 5 million in negligence, something like that. So you leave the flexibility to the business to come and say, we've got special business reasons in our sphere why we want to include this clause. But I know that some countries are stricter. The directive only has a gray list. Some countries are stricter. They have a long blacklist, list of prohibited clauses, which are prohibited outright. I just am wary to say all my clauses should go in the blacklist, because we don't have that much experience of how this is going to pan out in practice. It's maybe safer to say, let's make it a gray list. Let's say these are usually unfair, but in theory, the business can still come and say why it's fair in particular circumstances. Now, maybe we can't, our business can't afford insurance to the same extent as business in Europe. Is that sufficient to answer your question? Then you said, why do I say that it must only give guidance to business? What about other service providers mentioned? Typically in the EU, in the European Union, businesses are bound by unfair contract rules legislation as well as state agencies. I'm not so sure about these unions and other service providers. In my wording, I refer to a business, but I don't have a big problem with that change to suppliers, which brings all suppliers in line with this obligation to have fair terms in their contract. I don't have a big problem with that. You can change that to suppliers rather than business alone. I just think that hopefully the courts will make that distinction. So somebody has told me, well, if you're saying if you basically almost prohibit the private hospital from excluding their liability for negligence, but what about the school who provides a field trip to the pupils? The parents of the school are only prepared to act as volunteers to take the children on this trip if they are not liable for negligence. Okay, if they can't be sued for huge amounts because one of the children maybe gets hurt along the way. So maybe there's a bigger reason to give them the chance to exclude liability from negligence than businesses, maybe. But anyway, if you keep it like this with the greater, you make it all suppliers, then the courts at least can say, well, we have to take into account that this is a business, so they can be expected to make sure that they're not negligent, that they only have a reasonable limitation on liability. We'll treat the school differently. Okay. Then you said to me, what about the role of the National Consumer Commission and the National Consumer Tribunal? I think this is not clear in this legislation. Section 51 only speaks about the powers of the court over unfair terms, but nowhere is it said expressly, as I said, that only a court has jurisdiction to decide on questions of unfair terms. Part of my submissions as well, which I didn't mention yet, if we want to have real consumer protection, we must give the National Consumer Commission more obligations in this area. And at least give them the explicit opportunity to bring applications for entities to stop businesses from using unfair contract terms without an individual consumer having to be involved in the case. This is what's called in Europe general use challenges. The Office of Fair Trade in the UK brings a general use challenge to court. They ask for an interdict stopping this business from using this term in the future if they deal with a business who don't want to remove it voluntarily. They don't have to involve the complaint about an individual consumer in that case. So I think the committee must decide that. I think there's argument against and for making it only the court who can pronounce on this, or the tribunal as well. I think that's a sort of a decision which the committee must take, yeah. But if it's only the court, then we must make very clear provision for proactive control, a greater role for the National Consumer Commission to actually go to court and to apply for interdicts against businesses who don't want to stop using unfair terms. Then you asked me about the dimension of the state, and what about state agencies? All I can say is I think state agencies should be bound not to provide provide unfair terms in their contract. Difficult for me to speak about the implications of other parts of the law. My colleague, Professor Mark Loebscher, didn't have time to make a submission to this committee on this bill. He did initially send in a submission on Section 61 product liability to Parliament when Parliament initially called for it. He thought that was sufficient. He didn't realize he had to do it again now. But anyway, in there he refers to the unintended consequences of Section 61. And I think one of his problems is with ESCOM now being liable for full damages if there's a problem with electricity and so on. You know, so I can't deal with that. He's done a lot of research on how product liability is dealt with in other countries. He also thinks the law can be improved if you look at the European directive on product liability and so on. So I'm not sure whether state agencies, to what extent they should be bound in other parts of the law necessarily, but this is the one that I know much about, which is unfair contract terms. I think they should also have an obligation not to have unfair contract terms in their contract. Then you asked about oral contracts over the telephone. I think the bill already provides for direct marketing. This would be seen as direct marketing. There's already a cooling off period. So if you decide that you no longer want to enter into the contract, was too rash, was too fast, then at least you can cancel the contract. If the term is, I don't think it should differ whether, if you want to complain about an unfair contract term which was read over to you over the phone, I don't think it should make a difference whether it's a written term or an oral term. You should still be able to complain about the term if it's an unfair contract term. But at least under the provisions on direct marketing, you'd be able to cancel the contract in the cooling off period. Then you asked me about other instruments, I think, from Europe, and whether I dealt. The Honourable Member Nicolaides comments now. So I think that was your. Sorry, my face is written to full. Okay, Honourable Member Nicolaides. Yeah, you asked me, let me go back to your first one. You said, why didn't I give these submissions some time ago? Because it comes a bit late in the process. Let me say that the initial call for submissions on the first draft of this bill the deadline was in March 2006. Just a few weeks before that, I arrived in Oxford when I started my research. So I wasn't ready at that point to give a submission on the grey list. And so I just started my research at 7 months then. So that's when the DPI initially called for submissions in March 2006, and I had just started my research and I was happening in other countries. What I then did, when my article appeared in the South African Law Journal on the grey list, I did send them a copy of that to say that we need a grey list in this legislation. But I didn't send them a proposed wording, I was just too busy at that stage. But I didn't get a response as to whether a grader should be included or not. But I think they didn't know about the fact that I said a grader should be included. And I hope you won't find it too late to do this now, because I think it's crucial for effective continuity protection. Then you asked about the financial implications of small and medium enterprises, and that they think that they would probably run to lawyers about to comply with this legislation. Well, I don't think there's going to be different financial implications if we include a grader or if we don't. Probably it's better if we include a grader. Even if we don't have a grader, they must still exclude unfair terms under Section 48. So they will be less likely to have concerns with lawyers to say, what does unfair terms mean? And I'm not even sure the lawyers would know what to say. But if we have a grey list, if they really cannot afford to go to lawyers, at least they've got an indication in simple words in the legislation what at the very least they should take out. You see, what at the very least are the terms which they must treat
bigger chance that rewriting your contract will be a wonderful experience. That your lawyer knows that all those terms are typically unfair. And maybe I could add that somewhere in this bill it says that in the interpretation of the bill, international instruments can also be taken into account. That foreign law can also be taken into account. So I think even, you know, even if the brain is in the legislation, somehow, hopefully, courts will eventually tell us that this is the type of terms that must come up. But I think, you know, we can't wait for the court. We have to do it now. We have to be proactive. We want to help consumers now. And we have to keep guidance now as to what is going to be. Then you said how exhaustive and non-exhaustive is this list and what if a new term is discovered? Okay. So my list has got 35 clauses. The directive was written in 1993. So all the directive clauses in my list. Let me give you an idea. In 2008, there's a new movement in Europe where the European Union sort of reconsidered all the law in their country, and they asked a certain study group on a European Civil Code to relook all the consumer protection rules that they've got there at present. And they came up with a so-called draft common frame of reference, which is, I think, what they would like to see in the future. And the greatest of the directive, there's no new terms in there than was in the greatest. Now, when the UK Law Commission in 2005, after years of experience with the directive and with the Office of Fair Trade enforcing the provision against unfair terms, the UK Law Commission did not really go beyond the directive in their new list. You see what I'm saying? So, I think it's fairly complete. Now, I know, obviously, new terms might develop, but firstly, they can be treated under the general prohibition against unfair terms. Secondly, if you want to give the minister some power to add to the grey list, you could perhaps do what the UK Law Commission proposed. So they put the grey list in a schedule of the legislation. Schedule 1 or whatever of the legislation is the grey list. Okay. And then they give the minister the power to only amend that schedule, not to add to that schedule. Can't amend the rest of the legislation, which wouldn't be allowed yet. Possibly there's some case like Western case, something like that. She can't give the minister the power to amend a substantial part of the legislation. The reason is you could then amend his own power and give yourself better power. But if you want to, you could say the minister only has the power to add to the grey list in the schedule as a possibility. I'm not sure, you know, the constitutional expert here would have to tell us whether that is allowed in South Africa. But if it's allowed in England, I can't see why it's not allowed in South Africa. But that's a possibility. But in all the other countries, they keep the grey list. In Germany, they've got the same black grey list from 1976 until now. It's not changed, not added. And I've taken that into account in my draft. And then I think your last, I dealt with your question about state agencies, foreign contracts that you propose, and then you also asked me what about other instruments, other international instruments, and then I'll fully give you an example of all those. Unfortunately, you know, I'm also acting under limitations of time, and I've got other obligations as well as a lecturer and a researcher as well. So I didn't also argue in detail how the sale of consumer goods directive in the European Union better protects the consumer. I mean, just one example is, again, so I didn't say this yet, but you know, it's not so difficult to go to that directive. Again, there the consumer is given the choice whether to ask for repair, refund, or replacement of goods sold, not the supplier at the end of the door. There are certain protections for the suppliers to say, if it's unreasonable for the consumer to exercise its choice in a certain manner, you may not do so. You know, so I must say I haven't given all the examples, and because I knew that Mark Loach
Okay, I mean, no, from Saudi, I would rather you deal with all your responses from, and then I'd allow for one or two people if there's any other point of clarity.
Okay, and then the Honourable Ms. Mutuli asked me, I said something about ideally I would like to see separate legislation on patents. You know, there are various ways to deal with this. In the UK, there's different levels of protection in business-to-business terms and through consumer contracts. And what the UK Law Commission proposed is that we have different levels of protection for true consumers, that is, individual consumers not acting for a business related to their work or profession, for small businesses, and then for other businesses. That's an example. So, true consumer contracts, all terms are subject to review except for the price and the subject matter of the contract, provided they are formulated in a manner that the consumer can expect. The grayness applies to all terms. The difference is in small business contracts, small businesses cannot complain about individually negotiated terms, which the small business actually agreed to through individual negotiation. They can complain about standard terms. Standard terms is the pre-printed form which the other businesses always use when they're giving us a so-called fine print. So small businesses are allowed to argue about the fine print, but not about individually negotiated terms. And the list, the gray list, only applies to standard terms in the small business context. And in respect of business-to-business contracts, other business contracts, there is very limited protection. And certainly the list doesn't apply to business-to-business contracts. In Germany, for example, and the Netherlands, the Civil Code has got a separate section on standard terms. So there is only non-negotiated terms which may be complained about. The consumer is given a bit more protection because they've got a black list, a list of prohibited clauses which are far longer than our list. They've got a grey list. These lists only apply to consumer contracts. But in business-to-business contracts in Germany, the business may complain about the standard terms and non-negotiable terms, but the lists do not apply directly to business-to-business contracts. What happens in practice, as I say in my submission, courts tend to use the list when they deal with a business-to-business contract, but they don't have to do so. Okay? They would normally say, a list of terms normally unfair when you deal with a big business as against a small business, but strictly speaking, the list only applies to true consumer contracts. And the Netherlands is the most thing, the list applies to true consumer contracts. Okay, there are many other examples, but those are the main ones in Europe. Then you asked me to comment on section 44B. So that is my submission on page 14 of B1. I said section 44B, not satisfactory, and should be removed. Okay, so what section 44B says, said that, if you read the report first, to the extent consistent with advancing the purpose of the Policies of the Act, the tribunal of court must interpret any standard form contract or other document prepared, so that any restriction, limitation, exclusion, or deprivation of a consumer's rights set out in such documents is limited to the extent that a reasonable person would ordinarily contemplate or expect. Okay, so this means you must interpret it narrowly so that any limitation would be limited to the extent that a reasonable person would expect. But that, what I'm saying is that goes beyond the interpretation. That might sometimes mean you have to ignore the words completely. Let me give you an example. Right, there's a recent case in the Supreme Court of Appeal, Mercurius Motors v. Lopez. In that case, the consumer signed a form gave his car
garage to be repaired, and he signed the form, and on the back of the form there was a clause saying the business, the garage, is not liable if anything happens to the car. Now, the court said on the basis of common law that that clause does not bind the consumer because pricing that is contrary to the essence of the contract. You expect if you give your car for safekeeping to the garage that they will look after it. And if they say they've got no liability in that case if something happens to the car, that's unexpected. At the very least, it should have been pointed out to the consumer. Now, let's say you have to interpret that clause now. Let's say this form part of the contract. Now that you have to ignore the wording because the consumer couldn't have expected that clause. Now it's going to completely ignore the term. You're not interpreting it. You're ignoring it. You've got to say, no, it's completely unexpected. The court is now limited to what the consumer could have expected. It couldn't have expected the clause. We will say, interpret the clause isn't there. That's not interpretation, that's striking the clause out of the contract. And it's enough to say that the contract must be strictly interpreted here, I think, from its next. We already have a part in the legislation elsewhere which says unfair terms can be struck out. So that's why I've said this. Interpretation can't be ignoring the words completely. So then you're not interpreting, then you're doing something else, you're striking out. Finally, Dr. Rawley, you asked me about separate legislation in the business and franchise contract. I didn't fine-comb this bill in absolute detail for all the unintended consequences in business-to-business context. But I suspect that there are many. And for example, the provision of unfair contract terms, a business falling under this act would be able to say that a specifically negotiated term, even one that relates to the core definition of what it is that the parties are saying, that will be subject to review yet. And I think somehow we need, probably need more careful consideration of the unintended consequences from business to business contracts. Franchising, why I say we need separate legislation. We've already seen that the DTI has amended their original draft to take out franchise contracts from section 14 on expiration on fixed term agreements. So franchise contracts you can no longer cancel on 20 days notice. So there they've seen that that was an unintended consequence from the first draft. I'm not sure what other unintended consequences there may be. And if we have separate franchising, so that's just, I was just a bit uncomfortable with putting business to business contracts in this legislation without there being a fine coming throughout of that sort of unintended consequences which may be fine in the consumer context, in the true consumer context, but may be problematic in the business to business context. That's what I thought.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Prof. Churchill, thank you. I'll give the opportunity to Member Jela to make a follow-up question thereafter. I give the opportunity to comment and have a say. Good morning.
Thank you, Chair. My follow-up question is around the now, I respect to making reference to parents of the kids in school, which is rather a situation that applies to data that is provided. Another area is that in both judgments, I presume you should be highlighting an approach of differentiated or separate legislation, whereas the deal would like to rationalize quite a number of pieces of legislation into one. claim in the position is that he makes a strong argument that the National Credit Act and FICA are more relevant for the financial sector rather than in the argument. Given that the financial services are significantly connected to the market, the very little that's done in the course of the financial services provides a significant outside the contract, then how relevant is it? Because I assume that they left the idea what they want to be done, things too, but much more of their regulation of the treaty framework anchors on the Credit Act and FICA more than the deal.
Then you asked me about separate legislation.
Now, I think I'm a bit scared. I want actually separate legislation to deal comprehensively with this problem. But on the other hand, I can see that the political world is now here to give consumer protection against unfair contracts. I'm a bit worried if you take it out that when would it happen? In 10 years? In 15 years? That we'll actually get unfair contracts in this legislation. So ideally, we should get unfair contracts in this legislation. Now, we deal with all the types of contracts, but now it's in the bubble. There is some political rules to proceed with this, so it's not such a bad thing if you do it now. So what I've done in my proposed text is here and there, I have built in some differentiation between true consumer contracts and the other business contracts covered by the law. So you see, in section 1, on page 1 of B2, I said that a term which is unfair between a business, you can make it a supplier otherwise, and an individual, you know, won't be binding unless the term is fair and reasonable. And then in subsection 4, I say other contracts covered by the law. That is a part of true consumer contracts, where an individual enters into the contract for purposes unrelated to his business, so in the other contracts covered by the law, the business contract, then the consumer cannot rely on negotiation change in favor of the consumer, unless that term is fair and reasonable. So what I'm saying is, individual consumers acting for goods not related to their business, they can challenge all terms in their contract, okay? But in the other contracts covered by the Act, business to business contracts, like small businesses, they can complain about the standard terms, the fine print, the non-negotiation. And so I did, even though I said I needed to do that separate legislation, I did provide some differentiation in my proposed wording, which I think is insufficient. You know, the problem with asking separate legislation is the South African Law Commission already in 1998 proposed that we get unfair contracts in this legislation. 10 years later, it still hasn't happened. I'm not sure when the Department of Justice now the political role to get some particular protection here. Perhaps, ideally, it would have been better if we have separate legislation, but let's put it in here, but we may make a distinction between true consumer contracts and business in the text of the may be a compromise between the two. All right, and then I want to ask about the National Credit Act, FISA, and the brainless and so on in this context. I couldn't come to the oral commission yesterday and the day before, so I'm not sure exactly what was said. I think what you're asking is, is it right to exclude all these sectors from this bill? And rather have separate legislation for insurance, fiber and so on? And what then about the brainless? Well, I would want to see my brainless apply to all consumers. So if they want to exclude the insurance from this goal, and then, as we hear, I promise, at least they will review all those acts again and see whether they have sufficient protection, whether they're in line with this goal, and then they should make the greater applicable to them as well. I hope that answers your question. Then, some things you asked me about the possible uniqueness of the South African situation. Did I consider whether the overseas legislation is also appropriate for the South African context? Yes, I did, and I didn't only look at European examples where there's more funding, I suppose, and more rich society. I also looked at what I could find in developing countries. And even the model of the fuel station in Africa, even though it's not a very good document, at least in that model there's already a not a very good one, but it's there. So I don't think my primary submission is on a grey list. And I think that's the mechanism that should be used everywhere. But I just think about that cross something, that's why my grey list. I also looked at added a few terms which is typically found in South African standard terms, which I think is unsafe. And I mentioned the example earlier of inciting the supplier to charge costs, legal costs, on a higher scale than would normally be allowed. But not giving that same right to the consumer as well, because the consumer wins the case. So how it works in a court case is, if I'm successful, the other party, the user, must pay my costs, but they will pay it on a specific tariff, or the imported cost. So, but in the contract, you are allowed to say, but I can get more than that. The consumer must agree that I can get more than the party.
Thank you very much. interest I want us to flag with the department and also members. Last night, for a number of different reasons, I had opportunity to look at the bill as we have received it from the NCOP. And I want a correct knowledge. There's a long title there, raising the bill, and then it's followed by the preamble. At the appropriate time, I think we can do much better than what we have there. There are even some mistakes and faults there. I'm just playing the issue. The first? Quickly, I would like to welcome the delegation from Transnet. I must say it's a very balanced and gender-sensitive delegation. In terms of the DEE scorecard, you just have lost out on the black and white, but I've learned that you are gender. Welcome to Cook. We are in your evening.
Thank you. I'd like to introduce my colleagues, Terry and Peter Bowen.
So then I have to correct myself on the DEE scorecard. So you qualify in all respects.
Thank you, Jeffers. And another example of black came to mind as you were speaking earlier, and that is the notion of my little black book. And your little black book, if you have one, is your list of most important people in your life and all their contact details. So I always love that example as well. I want to thank the committee for the opportunity that you've given us today to raise a few matters with you. We did submit our comments to Parliament on the bill as originally introduced to obtain clarity on a number of important matters that are material to us and which we think are important to take in how the bill will be utilised in the future.
You have to lower your mic just a bit.
Sure. Sorry, that's it. Thank you. So the purpose of our presentation today is to really just bring to your attention what we have distilled as four main points which we think we'd like to discuss with you and to give you some examples of how these play out in practice in the work that we do as a state-owned enterprise. And I'd like to begin this by saying that Transnet obviously supports the objects of this bill and its intention of consumer protection. So our submission does not in any way go against that objective. But we do feel that the bill leaves considerable uncertainty for us, and if we could get clarity on these key matters, many of our concerns would be allayed. Brief background, and I'm sure that the members are well aware, Transnet is a state-owned enterprise. We're wholly owned by the state. We are a Schedule 2 public entity in terms of the Public Finance Management Act, and we are required to run as a self-sustaining company. In other words, we receive no subsidies from the fiscus. We run a completely self-sustaining business. And the business we run is an integrated freight system for the country, specifically the integration of services in the ports, the rails, and the pipelines. So we're a critical part of the day-to-day running of the South African economy. And in that respect, we are both in this bill a supplier and a consumer. And if I can go then to the main four points that we'd like to raise with you. The first question is really, is it the intention to exclude organs of state from the application of the bill? And in our view, the way that the bill is crafted at the moment is not completely clear as to whether we are included or excluded. And the chairperson, we do need certainty on this in order to run the business appropriately and be able to provide the services that we do provide. And I'd like to just explain to you, give you some examples of the way in which we are both in clause 5.2a of the bill, there is an intention to exclude the state insofar as the state is the consumer. That's what 5.2a does. And in that regard, we are a consumer of a number of services. For example, we enter into contracts in the port with stevedore companies to provide critical stevedoring services on a day-to-day basis. That's the handling of that cargo. We enter into security contracts, dredging contracts, major construction contracts for big investments that we're doing, and for the normal goods and suppliers and services that we run. And in so doing, we run an open competitive process, and we have to do that for the contracting of these services. So we're a consumer of those particular services. And our understanding is that in that capacity, we are excluded from the provisions of this bill. But we're not completely sure whether that is the case. And we request that you look at the drafting on this matter just to give us some certainty on that. As a supplier, we are a major supplier of services in the port, in the rail system, in the pipelines, and in rail engineering. So in the port, we provide cargo handling services. So we enter into contracts with shipping lines to handle the cargo that moves across the seaboard on a day-to-day basis. We provide piloted services to vessels so that they can be piloted safely into the port. We provide tug services to guide those vessels into the port. We provide vessel traffic control services and lifeline services to provide the safety of the movement of vessels in and out of our port system. In the rail sector, obviously we transport cargo, both bulk cargo, the big mining products cargo, as well as containers and great bulk and automotive. We do quite a lot of work with the automotive sector moving vehicles from points of entry or exit into the country to where they're destined to arrive. In the pipelines, we move liquid bulk. We move fuel imports from the coastal ports up to Gauteng in our pipeline, and we enter into contracts for the movement of gas in a pipeline. And so these are all large contractual relationships that we have. They are transactions that we do on an ongoing basis, and mostly they're part of a major supply chain. So in that respect, we assume that the provision of clause 5.2b(2) of the bill would apply. In other words, that because we are a part of a major supply chain in the movement of those goods, that we would be excluded. But again, it's not completely clear whether we are subject to the application of this bill or not. And I hope that those examples have given you some sense in which we are both a consumer and a supplier, and that we need greater certainty as to what our obligations and rights are in this draft legislation. So that's the first point on the slide in front of you, that we would like greater clarity on. The second point is also a matter of the extent to which the bill applies to us or does not. And the question here is, what is the threshold value contemplated in order to achieve the objectives of the bill? That uncertainty, again, leaves us with quite a lot of unclarity as to whether our transactions fall within the ambit of this bill. And we would like to recommend that threshold be set in the bill itself, as it is in the National Credit Act, and we would like to refer the committee to the provisions of the National Credit Act in that regard, and we do believe that would create a lot of certainty for all parties as to the application of this threshold value. The third point that we'd like to raise is the question of the exemption under clause 5.2b, where the drafting implies that one has to pass two tests, as it were. Both the transaction value has to be above the threshold, and the transaction has to form part of the supply chain process. We would like to suggest that that if either the transaction is above the threshold value or it's part of the supply chain process. In other words, that these two matters are not necessarily linked. If one considers that the bill may, and we think it does, also apply to leases, this is quite an important matter for us, because a lease, I think, could not be considered as part of a supply chain transaction. And it may or not, may not be above the threshold value. Most of our leases would probably fall above the threshold value, but again, I'll just give some examples. In our courts, we have leases with terminal operators, which are long-term and which involve significant investment by the parties that are the lessees, and they're very, very important contracts for the continuation of the economic activity of the port. Likewise, in our rail system, we are increasingly allowing and providing opportunities for rail operators in our secondary network who wish to lease a rail track to be able to do that and to enter into a medium or long-term lease agreement with us to perform a rail service on that network. And we cannot imagine that that would be considered as part of the supply chain, but it may fall above the threshold value, and we believe that it would not be appropriate to include those within the ambit of this bill. The fourth point that we'd like to raise on this slide is a point that the professor touched on earlier in the presentation this morning, and that is with regard to Clause 14.1 of the bill, the provision for fixed-term contracts. We are concerned about the unbalanced allocation between consumer and supplier that is provided for in the statute, in the Strauss statute. We particularly want to draw the attention of the committee to potentially unintended consequences. And there are two that we'd like to highlight. The first is the consequence of imposing a statutory period for termination of fixed-term contracts. And again, if I can give the committee an example here. A stevedoring company will contract to Transnet Port Terminals, which is our major terminal operator. That stevedore company is a supplier to Transnet. It may cancel its contract on 20 days' notice in terms of this provision, and it would not be possible, it would simply not be possible for us to replace that stevedore company in that period of time. Not only do we have to go through an open competitive procurement process in terms of other legislation, but the safety risks of that contract are significant, and we vet our suppliers very, very carefully because we are liable to ensure a safe and secure environmentally appropriate service in these tough working conditions. And we think that this 20-day statutory provision could cause significant problems in the ongoing business of supplying these critical services in our ports. And I could give a number of other examples where we think that the statutory intervention into a common law environment is inappropriate. The second aspect that we'd particularly like to draw the attention of the committee to on potentially unintended consequences here is the provision for the automatic continuation of fixed-term contracts. Again, here's an example. We enter into contracts with mining companies. They then become a consumer of a service that we supply because we move their product from the mine to the port. Even when that contract comes to an end, and these are complex negotiated contracts of a fairly sizable nature, even when that contract comes to an end in terms of Clause 14.1, Transnet would have to continue to run a costly rail service on a month-to-month basis until the consumer, in this case the mining company, decides to terminate. And in this circumstance, we would have no right to enforce the fixed term of the contract that we had negotiated in the first case and that had in fact been agreed between the parties. And we think that's not a reasonable situation for us to conduct. we do believe that it would be relatively easy to clarify these methods, particularly if we clarified whether organs of state are in or aren't, both as consumer and supplier. If the threshold value was determined in the legislation and then was certain, and if there was a distinction between those exemption requirements of threshold value and supply chain, if it was an or rather than an and, we think that that would assist to clarify the situation. And we would specifically like to request a review of 14.1 in respect of fixed term contracts, because we believe, and it may well be in other sectors as well, that there may be a number of unintended consequences to the extent to which this clause overturns common law rights in contracts. Thank you very much for your time today, and I would certainly welcome any questions or clarity or discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Members, comments, questions? Better have been.
Thank you, Chair. With in respect of my first family by counsel, it's quite important that mothers that are not here must be classified as a second in many organizations, including the state institutions. The question that I want to ask relates to the issues that have been raised from the beginning of this public hearing, in that the state and its institutions, depending on their activities from time to time, must be included at times as a consumer, and at times as a supplier. So I don't know in your case, that you have kept out, would you be satisfied that both must apply?
Thank you. Next was comment Vanessa, followed by comment
Thank you, Commissioner. I just wanted to perhaps get some clarification. You know, in your submission, in front of me, you asked me some questions in terms of what threshold value, and most of it are questions in terms of what's the intention of the bill. I somehow get the impression that there seems to be no clarity with regard to the intention of the bill in your submission. So perhaps if you could give me some kind of clue or indication as to your inquiry here in terms of threshold value. What would you imagine the threshold value to be? Because that's what you were asking me for. In terms of the intention of exclusion of organ of state, I think that is true. The bill does allude to that. But perhaps you could just give us some idea as to your inquiry, because all of them are questions in terms of your submission. So I just wanted to say that.
review of certain threshold of temperature, but not more than 5 years, may have a potential pendulum effect. Bring the same transition in out of the ambit of the field as a result of flexionary fluctuation. Now one needs to understand that there is in the same paragraph at the end, you then seem to be saying that you would like to take consideration to review that the reviewer monitor should be more frequent or be done more frequently according to economic development that would trigger such a review. I'm really trying to stress you that, you know, the pendulum effect due to inflationary fluctuation and supposedly more frequent review of the threshold due to economic development. Can you help us on that, please, you know, so that we can be able to apply on as a big step? Thank you. Transmit your opportunity for a rejoinder.
Our understanding is that the bill as drafted does exclude us in our capacity as a consumer. So our understanding is that 5.2a does that because it says this act does not apply to any transaction in terms of which goods or services are promoted to the state or are supplied to or at the direction of the state. In other words, the organ of state as a consumer is not included here. Now our understanding in our examples would be that means our contracts to do with security, construction, supply of goods and services that we do on a day-to-day basis are not within the ambit of the bill. Our concern, and we're not sure that the drafting is completely clear on that, and we'd like the drafters to have a look at the drafting to see that we actually do create absolute certainty, because we've read it over and over and we're not sure that it does. So perhaps that needs a little bit of attention. But I think that's the intention, because that's what the memorandum says. The second aspect is our role as a supplier. In other words, the main job that we are set off by the state to do, our job as mandated by the Minister of Public Enterprises, is to provide rail, port, pipeline, and rail engineering services to the nation, so that we can promote economic development. Now, that is our core business. And we want to know whether it's an oversight that aspect of our being was included in this bill, or whether it was in fact the intention to exclude that aspect of us as well from this bill. And we, in reading clause 5.2b, We felt that it was the intention of the drafting to exclude us in that capacity as a supplier, because there's a threshold considered and there is the supply chain notion that we are just a cog in the wheel. And in most of our dealings, we are a cog in the wheel. We are not the supplier of the service to a retail consumer on the whole. I mean, occasionally we have somebody who's wanting to move house and move all their goods in the container from A to B. But that's a relatively small part of our business. Mostly we deal with very large contracts as part of a bigger supply chain. So we think that it's the intention here to not include our supply part of our business in the ambit of this bill. But there's too much uncertainty in 5.2b for us. We don't know what the threshold value is. And we don't know that all of our transactions would be in that supply chain category. And furthermore, we have to be both above the threshold and we have to be in the supply chain category in order to be exempted. So 5.2a seems to exclude us on the consumer definition of our product, to the extent that we are a consumer. 5.2b seems to intend to exclude us in respect of our role as a supplier, but we're not sure. And Chair, this is where the uncertainty lies. We, you know, if the if it was the threshold or the supply chain test, then again we would know that there would only be a small part of our business that we serve a particular end consumer that we know we would fall under the annex of this bill and be happy with that. But it's the uncertainty that provides us with a great deal of difficulty. So I hope, Chair, that that deals with the first question of the Honourable Member, and perhaps the second question of Honourable Member Mohammed as well, because I think she was saying, what is it that's not clear? And I'm hoping that that answer has helped to clarify what it is that is uncertain for us, and that we're seeking clarity in the drafting on. Should I continue on the other questions, or should we engage on this one particularly, Chair?
Yes, let's exhaust this one.
I think you got it right, that I'm concerned about your uncertainty. But it would help us if you could, if you could possibly help us with some kind of wording that would narrow the gap of this uncertainty. Because somehow, you rightly did pick up the essence of the book to say that there is a possibility that there might be a question because of the factors. You see, and we have been looking into the beginning for quite a while, and people are concerned about their own factors. And it helps us to see how these factors see themselves putting into the book. Because that will help the drafters also and us to get a proper understanding as to where you will slot into this book. And that will help us even to make your delivery to your smaller clients, which you actually articulated. It will help us to then clarify that concern.
Thank you, Chairman. I mean, we are certainly willing to make suggestions on that, and I think we would make suggestions in respect of the drafting of 5TA, just to create a little more certainty on the exclusion of the trade as consumer. And secondly, on the drafting of 5TB, we would also very willingly make some suggestions in that regard to get a greater clarity. We have given some attention to the drafting, particularly of using the example of the National Credit Act, where the threshold is included in the bill itself, in the Act itself in that regard, and we believe that it would be appropriate to create that certainty here. So, Chair, if you will allow us, after this presentation, we can revert to you with some suggested wording in that regard, if you give us that direction.
In regard to that, your first of all will give the department to communicate to them.
Thank you very much. Then moving on to the last two matters, we would support the suggestion that 14.1 be further considered in respect of these fixed-term contracts. We can see the intention behind them, particularly to protect the consumer. We understand that, but we do believe that there are a number of unintended consequences here. And perhaps, again, listening to our member about the number of different sectors that have made representations, it might be useful to think a little bit more broadly about the impact of this clause on a number of contractual relationships in the marketplace. Dealing with the matter of the threshold and the pendulum effect, I think our submission really went to the matter of inflation over time, if I can put it like that. If you set a threshold of 1 rand in year one, the 1 rand in year two is no longer the same as the 1 rand in year one. In other words, inflation erodes the value of that threshold. So what you have in contractual terms is that your contract is moving in and out of the threshold value because of the effect of inflation over time. And so again, there's uncertainty. So one needs to build into the threshold determination a provision for inflation, for an indexation that will allow you at any moment in time to determine whether you are inside or outside of that threshold. If one doesn't do that, then the efflux of time changes the value of that threshold. I'm not sure if that's
Sure, I think perhaps to put it in context is that the comment made in our submission was also linked to the proposal of having a clause similar to what we have in the National Credit Act. And what the National Credit Act says, minimum of the term of the threshold pay, and the initial threshold of the determination should be at least 500,000 rand. Now, determining that number already starts creating the potential of the pendulum effect. So if the first threshold is 500,000 rand, the contracts that are concluded in year two for the same value, for the same commodity, is now 750,000 rand, it all of a sudden moves into the ambit of the Act. So if you consider our proposal that a category or an amount should be used as a benchmark to increase the threshold or to determine the threshold, we should just give consideration to the fact that that might have an impact on where your contracts lie at that stage. And that is why I think we're not well placed to make a proposal regarding what the threshold should be, whether it should be a million rand, whether it should be a half a million rand or 2 million rand. Because if we determine a million rand today as a threshold, only in 5 years' time we're going to determine it again. The same commodity transactions might then be 1.2 million rand. So all of a sudden, the contract that you concluded yesterday falls today under the ambit of the Act. And that is the danger in this whole thing. And perhaps one of the proposals would be then to also look at the kind of consumer price index link in this regard. So it was the comment was made in our submission linked to the proposal similar to the National Credit Act, because determining that particular threshold might have this effect if you don't look into a further trigger to redetermine that particular threshold.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the presenters.
Would you excuse us?
Yes,
no.
Stakeholders, I would like to thank you for having stayed the course. Just to say that where we stand now is for the department to interact with all the submissions made and thereafter to prepare the responses. Then we will engage as members of parliament with the department, work through all those responses, and thereafter will be the stage of finalizing the bill. So at this stage, it would seem that our next meeting, portfolio committee, will be next Wednesday, on the 10th of September. And then I would also like members to be aware that you have been given written submissions. I think there are 21, two pages or one page. There are 27 of those, to be exact. So nobody has spoken to those orally. So I would just like to remind us that we have to read those as well and be privy to what has been submitted therein. So that's your bedside reading for the next couple of days, good members. Just to make sure that you don't forget how I look. That's good reading. Having said that, I would like to thank everyone who has been part of the process thus far. Today being Thursday, this is where we end. Committee Clark says that she does not organize any lunch because we are supposed to be out here by 10 o'clock. She says it's the committee budget that stinks. She doesn't want to say it's the chairperson that stinks. Thank you very much.